From the Sky News Centre at 6, a gang's been jailed for a total of 221 years for sexual abuse against girls in and around Huddersfield. Tim Jones reports.
A judge says 20 Asian men planned offences against victims aged between 11 and 17. Police think there was a range of crimes.
Unthinkable sexual and physical abuse.
Prosecutors say the socially isolated victims were plied with drink and drugs.
They groomed them and exploited them for their own sexual gratification.
The 15 victims were abused over 7 years until 2011. Social workers insist lessons have been learnt.
The issue of child sexual exploitation was not well defined or understood.
The ringleader's been jailed for at least 18 years.
Devon and Cornwall Police has admitted breaching health and safety laws following the death of a man in custody. Thomas Orchard died in 2012 after being restrained and having an emergency response belt put across his face. Chief Constable Sean Sawyer says standards were not met in 2002 to 2012.
In the spirit of candour and out of respect to the family of Thomas, the courts, the public and my workforce, I have decided it's only right to plead guilty.
The UK's most prolific terrorist recruiter, Anjem Chowdhury, has been freed from prison. The 51-year-old will have to wear an electronic tag and need permission to use the internet. A man's been convicted of murdering his grandmother in the West Midlands after building up a £35,000 gambling debt. Gregory Irvin, who's 26, stabbed Anne James 30 times at her home in Walsall in February. A big cat expert's been called in to investigate a number of reports of black panthers loose in Ayrshire. Police now say they've ruled out that type of animal, but they can't confirm what it actually is. And Facebook has hired the former Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg. The social media giant says the ex-Liberal Democrat leader is taking on the role of Vice President for Global Affairs. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
BCFM 90.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Also, we're hoping to have former Bradley Stoke councillor, who's on the UKIP National Executive, Ben Walker. Also, Norman Rogers, chairman of the charity that runs the Ashton Court Miniature Railway. And former Sunday Times journalist, Kevin Cahill. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, the American assassins in Yemen. An incredible piece of news this week, which is, I suppose we have to call it Article of the Week. We ask also why Algeria is banning face veils. Is it just to help their facial recognition software? And 70 years after the end of World War II, facts are coming to light about dirty deals for enriched uranium done with the Nazis by the Americans and the British in the closing days. And the first week after VE Day for Nazi nuclear bomb detonator technology. We hear from author of the book The Nazi International, Joseph Farrell, on this and the organisations set up by Vice President Harry Truman. Roosevelt didn't want to use the atomic weapon against population centres in Japan, and then he dropped down dead. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after seven. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry and clear. This weekend, 15 Celsius. Make the most of the weather. It's going to get really cold after the weekend. So dry and sunny during this weekend, around 15. Next week, cooling down to 11. Tuesday and Wednesday may be cloudy, but the week looks dry. Next weekend, the 27th and 28th of October, cold and dry. North winds, chilly, but still sunny. The week after next, continuing cold and dry into November with ground frost. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Hi, Nicola. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Nicola. What's your professional background, and why did you get involved in city politics?
I'm a mental health specialist, and I joined the Labour Party a long time ago. I believe in collective responsibility, and I got involved in city politics because I'm really concerned that people aren't getting a very good deal, and somebody needs to represent people, really. And I didn't feel the City Council was particularly responsive to people who live on the outskirts of the city, which is where Froom Vale is.
Right, what about the Labour Party? Why Labour? Why not one of the other parties? I see you've got your Unite the Union South West t-shirt on there.
I know, it's Wear Red Day today, so I'm following suit, really. Well, I don't think there's any other...
Actually, Kevin, who's with us here, he's got a red handkerchief. Has everyone else got a bit of red on there?
Red.
No? Shame on you.
Just you two, then, OK. So, yeah, why Labour?
Well, Labour is the party that is aligned to the socialist values that I hold. I certainly couldn't join the Tory party, and I don't think any of the others really have views that are similar to mine.
But what about, I mean, we've had the Blairite Labour faction, which is extremely strong, probably the majority of MPs in the Labour Party, which isn't very socialist. In fact, a lot of people would just say they're neoliberals who are conveniently sitting in the Labour Party, but their values aren't really, certainly they're not that socialist.
Well, you know, political parties change over time, and I think that Blair came into power not long after Thatcher, and you know, he did an awful lot of good things, so we can't forget about that.
What, like the war in Iraq? That's what everyone remembers him for, though, isn't it?
It is, sadly, but, you know, he did a lot of good things, so...
Well, one of the things, I mean, I certainly agree with Northern Ireland. That was very important, wasn't it?
Yes.
Blair and Mo Molan made sure that happened. Kevin... I mean, you're Irish. What do you make of that whole business with Blair? And what do you think of Blair generally and the Labour Party?
Northern Ireland was in a bad place. Too many people were being killed, and he's got to be given credit for sticking with that. Although, oddly, it was John Major really laid the foundations. Blair picked them up, but he drove them home. And it is a lot of lives have been saved.
Now, look, we're also joined this evening by Norman Rogers, who's chairman of the charity behind the Ashton Court Miniature Railway. Might sound a bit obscure, but you're actually under threat, unbelievably, aren't you, Norman?
Yeah, we are indeed at the moment. Mainly from a financial point of view, we don't quite tick all the sums boxes in the City Hall.
So how long have you been involved with the Miniature Railway, and how long has it actually been there?
Well, I've been involved, having a lifelong interest, since I was a young boy. But I've been involved with the Bristol Club now for about 14 years. But the railway's been in Ashton Court State Park for 46 years, and we were in another park in Bristol before then, taking us back almost to the end of the Second World War.
Amazing. So you say you're from another park. One of the suggestions from Asha Craig, she's the deputy mayor or assistant mayor, I'm not quite sure.
Deputy,
what
I believe.
Say,
yeah.
Is that you might want to move to another park, please. So if you've come from another park, surely that could be a runner, couldn't it?
It could if one of the other parks that they've mentioned to us was actually suitable. There's all sorts of problems surrounding them. We have done an extensive survey of the options they put before us, but we really don't find any of them come up to what we really need for a successful operation.
So you'd rather close?
No, we wouldn't rather close at all.
Well,
far from it.
Find somewhere else.
We're still trying to come to a working arrangement with the Parks Department right now.
Well, let's hear from Marvin Rees, the mayor, because at the recent full council meeting, he explained one of the reasons why they're putting pressure on you, because you're not bringing enough money in, and also you're denting the receipts from other attractions in Ashton Court. So let's have a listen now to the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees.
Got some numbers here. So when the model railway is open to the public, the council... run golf courses takings drop by £230 a day compared to non-model railway days. And this is not actually offset by the rental income from the model railway. So what we do want to do is explore the potential value from other uses of this site, which is a prime site. So all we're currently doing is identifying opportunities as a result of the expiration of the railway's lease. And this comes within the context. So many statements today have been about council spending. And one of the challenges as we face less and less money come from national government is how do we maximise the revenue so that we've got revenue in our account to spend on special educational needs or housing provision and all those things that the city requires of the council. That's the challenging context in which we find ourselves, increasing need with shrinking budget, so we have to make best use of our land.
So what have you got to say to that, Norman?
In essence, there's some accurate statements in there. We are aware that the Golf operation suffers when we're there. But the real cause of that, I think, is the lack of provision for people to drive there in their cars and park up and go away to do their respective things for the afternoon.
But you're losing the council £230 every day you're operating from
yeah,
the
well,
from
we only,
Golf.
We currently operate 20 days a year. So, it is in perspective terms, it's not a huge sum of money.
There. I was doing my maths there. If you're losing the council £230 a day, that means you'd have to pay £100,000 a year rent in order to offset that. But obviously, it's not. You're not operating.
No,
rent.
I can't
anyway,
see that.
Nicola,
one.
Let's ask you what you make of this whole business because they're being told down at Ashton Court that the lease will be terminated. Now they've been given a year. This time next year, basically, that's it.
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a big tourist attraction. The city's in love with the miniature railway, and I think we need to protect it. We have sort of thought about nationalising it, but I don't think that's appropriate. You know, for what, 20 days a year you stay open?
At the moment, yes.
I mean, look at the amount of land there is at Ashton Courts. Surely other parts of the area could be used if it's about making money. Quite often we use, you know, economics as a reason to not do things, and I think we have to look beyond that and look at the value that you contribute to the life in the city. So,
but I can't quite believe, Nicola, you're disagreeing with your leader.
We're all entitled to our opinions, and actually what Marvin is saying is this is a point of view and that we need to, you know, have another think about it. And my thoughts are that we should keep the railway open.
So Marvin's saying he's going to explore other uses. He hasn't actually said what he wants to do. He just says that he wants Norman out.
Well, I think, you know, we need to explore the other uses, and you know, that doesn't mean that you should go, but we are entitled to think about other uses of the land. But I think we should think about the whole of that area, not specifically the little bit of that land that is used 20 days a year for children to have a lot of fun, to learn about railways. We've got a history of railways in this country. The Labour Party's trying to nationalise railways. There's a whole massive debate about railways, and I don't think it's a really good idea to get rid of them.
So what contingencies have you got if you're told this time next year, Norman, that that's it?
Well, we'll get 6 months' notice, so at least we have some time to act. But we are at the moment formulating some contingencies, because clearly if that does come around that we have to exit the site, and 6 months isn't a very long period of time, we've got to have a plan as to how we go about doing that.
Let's ask Kevin Carhill and Martin Summers what their thoughts are on this little railway. Kevin, first.
Well, I'm a fan because I know how much fun kids get from miniature railways. There's one down in Beer at Pecorama, and it's wildly popular. But if Norman's thing is costing the council £230 a day for 20 days, I mean, that's ridiculous. Norman, are you getting any money to develop, any grants or anything to develop the railway?
No, we don't get a grant at all. I mean, we actually don't cost, if you ignore the issue with the Golf, we don't cost Bristol City Council one penny. We pay our way in every respect. We even cut the grass, manage the trees, everything like that. No grants. It's all recycling railway revenue back into the railway.
So can I ask you how much the council does get off you every year?
It's 10% of whatever the railway revenue is.
So what's that roughly?
About £2,500 at the moment.
Well, that certainly covers the days that you're operating, doesn't it, with this £200?
Yeah, and they'd like us to operate more. But that multiplies up the number of times the Gulf is going to be hit. The root problem here is that there's not enough space for people to drive into the park and park up and then go and do what they want to do in the park.
There's also the manor in Nashton Court, which has been kind of left to go to rack and ruin. I mean, one would have thought with a little bit of effort that that could be rented out too.
Yeah, I don't know so much about the manor. I understand that a trust has got a two-year deal on it, but I'm not quite sure what they're going to be doing with it.
Well, let's hope that they fix it up and they can do things. Anyway, Martin Summers, what do you make of this little debacle with the miniature railway? It seems like it's a kind of Marvin the Party Pooper.
Well, I think that's part of the problem with the you know, in 2020, we're going to have no central government grant in Bristol at all, same as the rest of the country, and the local authorities
Hang on a minute. You're taking this economic argument, but Marvin hasn't even come up with something else he wants to do there that he thinks can generate more money.
Well, let me just put it this way. They've appointed somebody to be head of commercialisation, as we covered last week, which is the first time they've ever had that. And what's happening as a result of the pressure on local authorities to reach ridiculous targets, and of course the standard spending assessment has been rigged, so you know, big cities like Liverpool have been hammered, and East Dorset has been the most prosperous part of the country has been protected. But ultimately, you're then forced to commercialise your operations, which basically involves asset stripping. So ultimately, some big commercial organisation can say, well, we could make you some money from that space, a bit like the arena being moved to Filton and all the rest of it.
My point is that Marvin is telling Norman to sling his hook before he's even decided what he wants to do.
Well, that may be so, but I mean, the fact is what I object to about what's going on is the idea that we've got to face hard choices and therefore we've got to do X, Y and Z. In actual fact, what I want the Labour Mayor of Bristol to be doing is saying we need to change the government, and in actual fact, I haven't got much power, I'm basically a factotum, and I don't really need to hear Marvin telling me that by being clever we can work out these problems. We can't. Well, there's not enough money for special needs, there's not enough money for looking after social care, and the fact is there's only one solution to this, is to change national economic policy. The idea that Marvin is going to be able to do something like Superman in Bristol is just fantasy, and I rather resent the kind of, you know, managerial speak that goes with all of this. In actual fact, the situation is disastrous.
We're going to hear a bit more of that.
We just want to hear that it's disastrous.
We're going to hear a bit more management speak with Marvin's annual State of the City address, which I think he pinched from us because we have our second hour every week is up online as the State of the City report. But anyway, final word to you on this, Norman. What's your what would you like people to do? So I imagine your days are finished now for this year. It's getting quite cold. Have you got any more operating days? And otherwise, what can listeners do to help?
We've got no more general operating days now. It's the winter season, as you say, where we all go away to do things in a warmer environment. So that means a lot of us will be doing repair work and creative work ready for next spring. We've got a Santa special coming up in December, which we're hoping that will still go ahead. But other than that, it's a closed season now.
So when's the Santa special?
That's in early December, but it's fully ticketed, so it's all been sold.
Oh, no.
So I'm afraid. There's no more tickets.
You should do another day, yeah, because you've got so much publicity at the moment. Yeah. You should do another day and double the price for the tickets anyway. Nicola, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think you should ask Marvin to be your Santa.
Well, that's not a bad idea, actually.
Come on, Marvin, you heard it here first.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I'll write to him in the morning.
Okay, so we're going to hear now from Richard Carey. I spoke to him Wednesday evening this week, and he is a campaigner in something called Bristol Housing Action Movement, which I've been involved with for a few years as well, but he's convinced that Marvin is not taking the right approach and that really he's a kind of neoliberal mayor. So let's have a listen to Richard Carey now.
I think Marvin's definitely kind of outed himself as a real neoliberal. Everyone put their faith in him with all the Corbyn fever that was going on, as a socialist that would stand against the cuts, perhaps link up with the other mayors in the country. What we saw was pandering to the cuts, insensitive policies on homelessness, reduction in funding for the poor areas of Bristol, which happen to coincidentally be majority Labour voting areas, which you can...
Yeah, but the thing is, Marvin, if he was sitting here now, he'd say, Rick, it's not my decision. Actually, the money into the city council has been cut by the Tories in Westminster, so I cannot just simply keep putting money into things when I don't have as big a pie to go with in the first place.
That's a great spin that he would probably have been taught to repeat by Kevin Slocum, his personal minder, that probably cost a fair bit himself. But when he's spending so much money on evicting homeless people and creating injunctions, which essentially create no-go zones for homeless people within Bristol, you really need to question why he's spending money he doesn't have.
So why is he evicting homeless people? In what cases? Give us some examples.
There's the case of Greenbank. We had Greenbank, which was a group of van dwellers and caravan dwellers, also a homeless camp next to it as well. That area now has an injunction on. It didn't fit with his idea of what the city is.
Well, also, there was some serious fires and violence and things like that there, weren't there?
Yes, that's right. And as soon as the guys left from down there, there was a burnt-out car straight away. So it just shows that in areas that are out of the way in Bristol, you do actually have a lower level of car fires and other problems when you have people living there, because people don't want trouble where they live. Whether they're homeless or van dwellers, there's a sense of calm that comes from people sleeping in a certain area.
But surely this isn't the place for caravans, it just in the streets. I mean, surely there should be sites, that sort of thing, for specific sites for people to live on, rather than just pitched up along by the curbside in, in an ordinary residential street, like up in Greenbank.
Sure, and getting back to how Marvin is acting, we understand that we need homes. We understand that there aren't homes currently for people that are in caravans, vans, that are homeless to get into. But that doesn't mean that you can evict people, bring injunctions onto people. If they have nowhere to go, you're just sweeping the problem to another town, another area, or even into the shadows, such as the riverbanks, where, what is it, four or five people have died now on the side of a river, hiding from the council, who should be helping them.
When you said earlier on neoliberal, I think this is a bit jargonistic. When you say that Marvin is a neoliberal, what do you mean by that? Explain yourself.
Marvin believes that the salvation of the city is in investment and development. He seems to want to go abroad to gather funds from places with great records, such as the Philippines and Georgia and other...
China, Malaysia.
Wow. Yeah. So he's searching for funds that are not accountable in a way, because I guarantee if he asked every single Bristolian for a £20 note, they would quite happily invest in what he's trying to sell to them, and then they would be the owners of that particular investment and they would have a say in it, which I think he's scared of doing. He's scared of opening up investment to the citizens of Bristol because he knows there's accountability there. He'd rather just fly off to some distant country, grab some money, come back and do what he wants.
That's Richard Carey from Bristol Housing Action there. Martin Summers, is there any truth to this whole thing of neoliberalism at the council house?
Well, I think that Marvin would be offended to be accused of being a neoliberal, but I think in practice, accepting the constraints of being a mayor, he's taken over where George Ferguson left off, where he's going out and he's trying to get private sector money in to make up for the loss of public sector resources. And I think that that's a fundamental problem, as has been pointed out, because the private sector will extract a pound of flesh. And what I would like to see a Labour mayor doing, and the same goes for Sadiq Khan in London. Basically, mayors were a Tory idea. They're basically there to be Aunt Sally's, to do all the nasty stuff. And in actual fact, they should just turn around and say, we're not doing the nasty stuff, or we're going to do it, but we're not going to try and mitigate it by bringing the private sector in. Because this is what happened in Greece when they defaulted on their debts. All these people turn and say, right, we'll have this, we'll have that. And that's actually part of the plan. So Bristol City Council has actually got quite a lot of property, and that will all be flogged off because we haven't got any money, and that will be, that's resources that should be there for future generations being basically purloined.
Nicola, what do you make of this? We're going to hear a little clip from the State of the City address in a minute. Marvin's doing this week, his big speech of the year. But what do you make of this accusation about neoliberalism? Is this just jargon, or what do you make of it? Bringing the investment in from China, Malaysia, places like that.
I think it's really important that we do try to bring investment in. I mean, we are in a really difficult position. You know, by 2020, local authorities will have seen cuts of more than 5.8 billion. And so something has to be done. You know, Marvin is in a position where he's trying to manage a whole city on absolutely no money at all. And as we know, Labour councils are the most affected by Tory cuts. So I think we need to be really careful about the terminology that we use to understand what the Conservative government is doing to local authorities.
We're doing things. One of the things that Marvin's talking about is putting lots of private housing in Spike Island, doing things like having a possibly a tunnel underneath the river there. These sorts of things are not necessarily going to make much of a difference for ordinary people, though, are they? And particularly about the homeless that Rick's talking about. The idea that the homeless are afraid of council civil enforcement officers, so they're having to hide. I mean, this is really, it's almost like a kind of social cleansing, isn't it?
I mean, that's the first time I've heard that. And, you know, to hear that people have died because they're hiding, I think that needs to be investigated. That's really concerning. I do know that Paul Smith is doing an excellent job in the city of Bristol around housing. So, you know, maybe that's something that he could look into.
Kevin, what do you think? Inward investment from Malaysia, does it make sense?
It's capitalism, and it's not going to make sense in the long term without some amelioration. The Malaysians are a very committed capitalist. They'll want their pound of flesh.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to the State of the City speech. I thought, I mean, it was an amazing 20-minute warm-up. I don't know if you were there, Nicola, were you?
No.
It was a 20-minute warm-up session up at the Wills Building, the university, and I couldn't quite believe it. So, you know, people, I suppose the idea is after 20 minutes, you're getting really excited. Here comes the mayor, here comes the mayor. Well, so what I'll do is I'll give you a little taste of the video just before Marvin dramatically appears on the stage.
Partners in the west of England are pressing ahead with plans for a mass transit system that will reduce congestion and pollution, creating a cleaner, greener, more connected city for the future. It's an ambitious vision, and Bristol certainly has the energy, creativity, and drive to make it a reality.
A lot of people here. Well, thanks for coming out this evening. Really appreciate you making the time. And I suppose there's two things I just want to start with. One was just talk about our city poet. And I think in what you heard this evening, you really get a sense of what we're trying to, what we hoped would come from a city poet. Someone who really captures the soul of the city. And I love that piece about, you know, things are rarely one or the other. Often things are messy, and we hold contradictory truths and descriptions of a place together at the same time. And that's one of the things that we have to contend with, something that politics struggles to work with. And I also this evening have to say happy birthday to Bristol Cultural Development Partnership, which is 25 years old this year. And which makes these events possible. So for the past 25 years, we've worked with the Arts Council England, Business West, University of Bristol and the University of the West of England in developing cultural projects across the city. And I'm sure you'll agree it's a huge contribution to what we are, the way we work, and engaging people in the meaningful questions of our city at this time. So someone clapping them, not me. That wasn't scheduled in, but there you go.
Well, it's feeling a bit awkward for people when they expect people to clap and then they don't, and then they sort of send out a kind of little visual signal. Is it? It's time to clap now, please. A little bit embarrassing for Marvin there, but he was talking about, Nicola, he was talking about the 25th anniversary of the Bristol Cultural Development Partnership. What he didn't say was that in 2009, community reps like myself, I was from Vosca, and also from the faith communities in St Paul's, were removed by Business West from the Cultural Development Partnership. So it's become an elite organisation, really. So it's Arts Council funded, it's Business West funded, it's City Council funded, UWE and Bristol University.
But actually, the ordinary people, the ordinary communities have now been excluded from these so-called partnerships. And they put forward this thing called the Festival of Ideas. Well, I mean, I just don't think that the ideas involved in the Festival of Ideas are particularly radical or interesting. It's a sort of sanitised version of what the city culture could be and should be. But anyway, obviously Marvin is trying to push this as a good thing, the Cultural Development Partnership. But does it make sense? I mean, this is a loaded question, terribly loaded question, but does it make sense just to have the bosses of all the organisations involved in this and the universities?
I think you need to start where people are at, really, and you need to get people on the ground involved. I mean, you know, my ward has no support from the voluntary sector, or very little support. There is some, and it's one of the big things that people are concerned about. So it's all very well having a few people, and it seems to be city centre focused, but it needs to spread out, and it needs to involve people of all sectors of the community, not just people who hold, you know, senior positions within the council. Otherwise, we run the risk of defining what culture is.
The city poet, last city poet was Miles Chambers, Martin Summers, wasn't it? Who he had a video he put out, which was talking about the protocols of Zion, for example. So that was a little bit iffy, and then that got taken down off the internet. I mean, I just said, look, this isn't necessarily very good, because this is the protocols of Zion is what Hitler used in order to persecute the Jews. Can we please get this removed from the city council poet's website? But it does seem, to try and cut a long story short here, the cultural life of the city is not the Bristol Cultural Development Partnership. It seems to me to be something which is actually more like a kind of elite version of it. So why is Marvin bigging it up and embracing it, Martin?
Well, the thing is, Bristol is seen as a cult city of culture, and therefore there's obviously an interest in trying to build on that in terms of, you know, the cultural industries are big here. Think of all the wildlife filmmaking, for example, and things of that sort. And, you know, there's an element of, well, how can I say, there's an element of backpatting going on here as well, isn't it? Aren't we great? Aren't we cultural? Culture is something that's natural anyway, and people can't really exist without having one. And so, in a sense, you don't really need to have all these infrastructures for culture. The sense of for example, let's make it more concrete. Think of all the small band music scene that you have in Bristol. We don't have a big arena. And that makes it rather different from other cities. Well, in my mind, more interesting.
The other thing we don't have is a theatre for amateur dramatic groups in the city centre to come and use easily, which we did. Used to be on Colston Street, I think, or Colston Hill, whatever they call it, that runs up from the Colston Hall just up to the Bristol Royal Infirmary. Used to be a fantastic little theatre there where all of the city's amateur dramatic people could come in and very cheaply do a production for the night. But I suppose the other side to this is what I mentioned at the beginning, which was the community representatives being removed from Bristol Cultural Development Partnership. So I feel, you know, if Marvin wants to celebrate 25 years of BCDP, he should bring back some of the real community representatives back onto that group. I even remember, this is the slave trade year, back in 2008, the abolition of slavery year, asking for somebody, when I was on the committee, asking for somebody who was a representative of the ethnic communities to be allowed to come into one of the meetings. Being told yes by one of them, and I think it was Carlton Romain it was to do with the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, and he'd been running Commonwealth FM, so he came and sat in on one of the meetings, and I got ticked off afterwards. Who was he? What was he doing in here? Now, how can you have cultural development if you're going to tell people off for having ethnic minorities sitting in the room? Because it was all white, all male organisation. So anyway, that's my take on 25 years of the Cultural Development Partnership. Let's have a few ordinary people back on the board. John Savage, because it was him that was running it. He was from Business West, and he just got rid of the community reps. Simple as that. So let's have another listen now to Marvin's, a little bit more of Marvin's state of the city. This time he starts getting into what his achievements are like. And I don't know about you, but I found this a little bit like the chairman of the board speaking to his shareholders rather than a mayor speaking to citizens.
I really appreciate the chance to have this annual address, because it's a really important moment in the year, because it's my opportunity to talk and connect directly with the city. This evening, I want to cover the progress we've made over the last 2 years show you how we have delivered on our pledges and set out the aspirations we've been growing for Bristol. I'd also like to take a little bit of time to share some personal reflections on the quality of political activism, debate, and commentary that the city of Bristol is subjected to. But let me start with a bit about Bristol City Council. Because in September, we opened our doors to a local government association peer challenge. We wanted an objective and expert assessment of the council undertaken at the midpoint of my administration. Now, the team they sent was drawn from across the country. It was made up of Labour and Conservative councillors and senior local authority officers and staff from the local government association. They spent more than 460 hours talking with over 200 people, including staff, local and national partners, and even opposition councillors. In the executive summary of their report, which will be published in the coming weeks, they said, "Bristol City Council is laying the foundations to underpin its improvement journey. The ambitious and collaborative leadership the Mayor has shown for the city is warmly welcomed by the Council's partners. Bristol City Council has recently appointed a new senior officer leadership team, which collectively has the potential to set a positive direction for the council's workforce. 2 years ago, the council was facing a funding crisis and commissioned an external review to assess its root causes and make recommendations to address them. 2 years on, the council's financial management and grip is stronger." They also say the sense of ambition for Bristol as a city is clearly evident, and many stakeholders we spoke to talked variously about their hope and optimism for the future.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, it's good words in a way, but as I said earlier, I'm personally not convinced by the underlying idea of cities as entrepreneurial centres and so on. Fundamentally, we're going to into a world we've never been in before, where we're not even going to possibly be able to fulfil the statutory obligations of local authorities for social care and special needs. So
but Marvin is talking this up, isn't he? He doesn't want to dwell on this dark side. He'd much rather say, "Look, here's what's going wrong."
Well, I think this is where I kind of part company with him, even though obviously I voted for him and worked to have him elected, is because ultimately I don't think there is a solution at city level to the crisis. You've got to change national policy, and the only reason that we participate in local elections is to build up our forces so that we win national elections. And the idea that that having a kind of charismatic mayor is going to resolve the funding problems of the city strikes me as facetious, really.
Okay, Nicola, what do you make of that last little bit of speech? He's talking really through some of the achievements, but then we've also got the first black mayor in the city, and it's Black History Month. We're not hearing a lot there or anywhere else about what's happening with the memorial to the slave trade or anything like that. Now, Liverpool's got done big guns, but not much down here.
I mean, you're talking about a peer review that's being carried out and the findings of that. And I think, really, we ought to be thinking about what ordinary people who live in Bristol, what their experiences have been, and somehow finding those voices and including those in the findings that Marvin's talking about. So that would be really useful.
What about this stuff like when we're hearing about this mass transit system? Big ideas.
You know, big ideas have to start somewhere. So there's no harm in having big ideas. It's whether those big ideas carry any costs with them and, you know, what isn't getting done at the same time that we're focusing on these big ideas. So there's lots of things really at play here, I think.
Kevin?
Yeah, I think this is worth commenting on. Marvin's words don't mean anything. They're waffle. He said hardly one concrete thing. And he's talking about bringing in bureaucrats. If you bring in bureaucrats, you'll be given a bureaucratic solution. You will not be told to go out and meet the people. People are messy. They cause problems. And bureaucrats don't like messes and they don't like problems. But it sounds to me like you are becoming corporatized.
in Bristol.
Okay, so, well, we've got this big event this weekend. It's called the Global Parliament of Mayors. In fact, actually, we've got quite a lot going on this weekend, folks. On Saturday, the whole of the National Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, that's tomorrow, is coming to Bristol, Saturday and Sunday, and they've got a something called... It's called Towards a Nuclear Free Future. It's their annual conference, and they'll be holding that here in the city both tomorrow and Sunday. I'm not quite sure where it is, but it starts at 9:30 tomorrow. I'll see if I can find it. I'll certainly put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Actually, it's going to take place also just where that State of the City address was. It's at the Wills Memorial Building on Queen's Road, University of Bristol, BS81RJ. So that's a big event that's happening this week. This weekend, but also on Sunday, we've got the Global Parliament of Mayors happening. Now, I guess, Nicola, that King of the Mayors is going to be Marvin himself.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but you know, I'm sure Marvin will play a prominent role in what's happening.
Martin Summers, one of the things, I've just looked at the list of the mayors from around the world that are attending, it's pretty thin. It seems that there's quite a lot of mayors around the world that don't really think that this event is worth coming to anymore.
Well, I don't know enough about it to say whether it's a successful event or not.
What do you
not.
Think about the idea, though?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the mayor of Bristol hasn't actually got any real power. Because it was a tour.
Hang on, he spends £350 million.
No, he doesn't, because most of that's already spoken for. In actual fact, there's a very small.
He's got the power to close down a miniature railway.
Well, he's got the power to close things down, and that's just about it. And that's what the Tories are the ones who wanted to have a mayoral elected mayoral system. And that's why they pushed it through. And that means you then get somebody to be a figurehead. And, of course, all the major cities are controlled by Labour mayors now. And all they can do is basically turn around on the people who voted for them and shaft them. Because that's all that's in the playbook. Now, what I want to hear from all of those mayors is, we're not playing this game, not... We're going to make the best fist we can of this. And I think that he's taken over from George Ferguson the idea that the mayor of Bristol is a terribly important person and can make a difference. I don't want to hear that from a Labour mayor. I want to hear the blood, sweat and tears speech, that it's a pile of crap and we don't know what to do about it.
What about the other... Well, there's another positive side to this weekend, also from Sunday to Monday, alongside the Global Parliament of Mayors. There's something called the Local Futures Conference, the Economics of Happiness, going on, which sounds a lot more positive. Martin, are you familiar with this whole sort of... I think the idea is that GDP and counting economic figures actually really is a measure of misery. So when you have very high GDP, people are very unhappy because they have no spare time and things like that. And so do you think that there's something to be said for this whole idea of gross domestic happiness? And that's what they'll be talking about in Bristol this
week. Yeah, well, I mean, nobody suggests that having high GDP makes you more unhappy. In actual fact, you know, there's pretty strong evidence to say that people in Sweden are much better off in their minds than people in Bangladesh.
Let me just explain why. And that's because now in the modern world, for a lot of people, most of this money, even though the amount of money that's going around the system is increasing, it's going on the basics. It's going on things like food, housing. And so people are having to pay way over the odds just to stand still.
Well, I'm not suggesting that the GDP does need to be critiqued, and happiness is important, and the people who are behind this have got a genuine and well-intentioned, but ultimately it's not just about GDP or about subjective ideas of happiness. One of the things that came out in the spirit level was that the more equal a society is, the happier people tend to be.
Well,
and there's lots and lots of statistics in that book about how that works.
Conference is Helen Norbert Hodge, and I'm sure she would agree with you on that last point, that more equality makes people a lot happier. So let's have a little listen to her now, because I spoke to her just recently about what is this whole Local Futures conference about, and asked her specifically what she thought of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, because surely that's what they're trying to do, is to redistribute wealth, to take money off the super rich from tax havens and things like that, and make sure that the poor have got enough to survive on.
I think Jeremy Corbyn is an absolutely wonderful person, but
I don't believe that he's going to be able to make the change we need to make without a much bigger movement, which is much clearer about what we need to do and how we can do it. Just following conventional labor policy is not going to do the job. They have been in bed with, as have the Scandinavian governments, with certain assumptions about how to grow the economy, and especially through supporting global traders, and that means global multinational corporations. Those corporations are not consisting of evil people. It's not about good guys and bad guys. But as a structure, they are completely unable to deliver the sort of livelihoods that we all want and deserve. They cannot deliver the care and the sharing that we need now. Instead of going down the path of robots, which I'm afraid at the moment, neither left nor right are really discussing the economy from starting from the bottom up and looking at what people need and what nature, the real economy, needs.
Okay, Helena, if you had the top position, if you were sitting in the Prime Minister's chair, what would be your first few priorities?
Number one policy would be to start a campaign in the media to explain to people how the current economy works, explain how we've handed over power to banks to create money out of thin air, and how that has allowed them to indebt the individual and the nation state. And progressively, they have made a few billionaires richer and richer while they've impoverished governments as well as people. So we have to look at the bigger picture to be clear about that actually fixing things in practical terms would be a lot easier than continuing down the path we're going now. And so my number one thing as Emperor of the World would be to explain how it actually works and explain in terms that five-year-old children can understand why we need to start prioritizing human needs and ecological needs. We have to, you know, really, ordinary people will not find it so surprising to hear that we shouldn't allow private banks to make money out of thin air. But our policymakers are so blindly caught up in an outdated, criminal, actually, idea of GDP. GDP increases with commercialization. So our nations have been promoting more and more consumerism, more and more built-in obsolescence, and with it, unemployment. Because they're subsidizing businesses to use more and more energy and technology to replace people in virtually every function. And it's happening in education, it's happening in medicine. Teachers are having nervous breakdowns across the industrial world, not just the industrialized world.
That's Helena Norbert Hodge there. Sorry, got the dates wrong. It's Friday, that's today, until Sunday in Bristol. That's, if you want to find it online, it's localfutures.org on their events calendar. And it's the Economics of Happiness Conference UK. And that was Helena Norbert Hodge Martin.
Well, I think Helena Norbert Hodge, I think I've come across her before when I worked for the New Economics Foundation. She's a green, basically, and there's a very sound critique of GDP. But I think what we need to do is change the components of GDP. We can't just have a no-growth economy, but on the other hand, the quality of the growth that we want has got to be much higher. Anything won't do. We've got to think more in terms of quality rather than quantity. In many respects, I agree with most of what she's saying.
What about this? She's talking about robotics there quite a lot. Maybe I'll ask you about that, Nicola, because this is big. We're talking about mechanisation. So jobs being done automatically, and there's not so much need for the jobs. But what happens to those people? They just get left on the scrap heap nowadays.
I'm a mental health specialist, so this whole thing about happiness is sort of really, of really interest to me. But people work not just for an income, they work for lots of other reasons, and we mustn't lose sight of those things either. You know, people need to have their basic needs met, otherwise they're never going to be happy, and you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time, really.
Is this the sort of thing you... Anyone here going to go to any of these conferences? We've got the Parliament of Mayors, we've got CND and the Economics of Happiness. I'll ask you all of you. Martin, you first.
Nope.
Kevin?
Nope.
Nicola?
No.
Okay, well, anyway, there's a lot going on this week. I'm sure for most of our listeners there'll be something out of interest out there for you. But I thought, since robots got a mention there, I didn't realise this, but there was another clip that I was going to play, and I'll play that now, because he's also talking about robots. He says they're wonderful and they're fantastic. And I don't know if you know what his name is. He is going to be, it seems, the next president of the EU Commission. He's slated for it anyway. And of course, these people aren't elected by us. They're just appointed to the jobs. Anyone know? Like to have a guess at what his name is? No,
and he's Finnish, isn't he?
He's Finnish. Absolutely right. His name is Alexander Stubb. So let's see what the next president of the actually, he's the president of Europe. The Commission runs the European Union. So I just find it quite amazing that, you know, that we can be told a year or so before he's appointed who's going to be the next person in charge, and no one gets a say in it whatsoever. Whatever your views on Europe are, on the EU, well, the national governments, but not the people.
Well, who makes the national governments?
Well, yes, but I mean, nobody elected Theresa May, did they? Not even to lead the Tory party.
In other countries like Finland,
you want to say something?
So I was just going to say the Conservative Party elected Theresa May.
No, they didn't. That's not the case, I'm afraid. There was a leadership election between her and Andrea Leadsom, and Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword. She never stood. So there was no election. Theresa May is in charge, but nobody actually put her in charge of the Conservative Party. She just got by. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to
Now look what we've got.
Oh, yes. Okay. Let's have a listen now to the person who's going to be running the EU soon, with no one actually voting for them, apart from, of course, as Martin points out, as he believes in this system of national governments doing the voting rather than the people. So let's have a listen now to Alexander Stubb, the next president of Europe.
Well, there'll be a deal at the end of the day. Because, you know, it goes through three phases: crisis, chaos, suboptimal solution. So we'll have a suboptimal solution at some stage. Not today, not tomorrow, not this week, but perhaps in November.
Yeah, there's an opinion poll out just yesterday in Italy that Italy, one of the founding members of the European Union, for only 44%, according to this poll, want to stay in the European Union. That's fewer than we have in the UK.
Yeah, it's true. But again, there is a link between Europe bashing and opinion polls. Mm. You know, you guys bashed Europe for 40 years and you see where you ended up with Brexit. And I think we need to have a little bit more open of a discourse about what Europe is about, good and bad.
But in Italy, there hasn't been Europe bashing for as long as we've had it in the UK. And yet, even there, people are losing faith.
Well, it's true. I mean, but the truth is that if you look at what Salvini is saying about Europe and the rest of it, then there is a lot of bashing going on.
He could be the next Italian Prime Minister. He sets the tone for much of European politics. How do you deal with someone like him?
Well, in Finland we have experience. There's no magic potion or one recipe, but what we did with the true Finns was to hug them to death. Took them into government in 2015. They had promised no more austerity. We pushed austerity. They had promised no more money to Greece. We gave money to Greece and they said no more migration, and 2015 was what it was. And at the end of the day, when they came to power, they realized they had responsibility, their popularity halved, and now they're out of government. So hug them to death is my answer.
You want to be the Spitzenkandidat, the leading candidate for the centre-right bloc. How will you try and reconnect that relationship between the European citizen and what goes on in this city here?
Well, the first thing to do is to connect with values. Remind that we have probably the most successful model of society, which is based on human rights, fundamental rights, liberty, tolerance, equality, liberal democracy, and the rule of law. That's the anchor that we have. If you're a political leader, you need to talk about hope and solutions, not about hate and failure.
Okay, so give me your hope and solution pitch in 20 seconds.
Yeah. First of all, take care of climate change. Make Europe a leader in it. And secondly, make Europe a leader also in technological development. That's the future. You know, artificial intelligence and robotization, it's going to change the economy and work. It's going to change politics and media, science, and probably the future of mankind. Let's do this together.
So that's the voice Alexander Stubb, former Prime Minister of Finland, telling us about how artificial intelligence and robots are the future. What do you make of the... first of all, what he had to say, Nicola, there about the future for Europe? No? Robots? No? Not interested? Okay, Kevin?
Okay, well, this is a subject that I know a bit about. Nobody has noticed that for most of the 20th century, the United States had all the biggest, fastest supercomputer. This is very important. They were had the most number of the machines. They had the biggest, fastest machines. 2 years ago, they fell down. They became number two, but by a huge margin. China has 206 supercomputers. America has 124. That's a bit of a gap. And the top machines since 2014 have all been Chinese. Europe doesn't have any stake in that part of the future, and everything is going to rely on supercomputers. Europe has no stake.
Martin, I think he probably will be the new president of Europe. Alexander Stubb was at Bilderberg in Dresden in 2015.
Well, it's quite likely. I mean, he's a centre-right you know, safe pair of hands person, isn't he? I think the issue of robotisation is definitely going to confront us, and we'll have to move towards a different kind of welfare state, for example, universal income.
Which yeah, he was talking about human rights there, wasn't he? But yeah. What about the human rights to have somewhere to live?
Well,
what about the human rights to not have to go to a food bank?
The model is something like Norway and Sweden, where in Norway it's got the highest standard of living in the world and also some of the happiest people in the world, but they've got a nationalised oil industry. And when they bring robots in, they'll make damn sure that their people are looked after. What we've got is a 19th century setup that is creaking at the seams and about to explode. That they live across the other side of the North Sea, and it's all different. I wonder why.
Nicola, what's your thoughts on Brexit? Bristol apparently is a Remain city.
Yes, it is. The Labour Party's come up with six tests for Brexit. Now, I totally support that, really. I think, you know, we have 150 days to go and we haven't got a deal. I think it's just a debacle that the Tory party have brought that we didn't really want.
OK, well, let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn in the Commons this week talking to the Prime Minister about why she won't make a deal.
Jeremy Corbyn, Speaker. The car industry is clear that it needs a new customs union in order to secure investment in British manufacturing. Vauxhall recently said they would continue to invest, but there are limits. Those limits are customs barriers. Jobs are at risk. Why won't the Prime Minister back a customs union supported not only by Labour and trade unions, but by businesses, and I suspect a majority in this House, to protect those jobs?
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman what the automotive industry and indeed other industries such as aerospace have said is that they want to see frictionless trade across the borders. Frictionless trade across our borders is exactly what lies at the heart of the free trade deal that is proposed in the government's plan put forward after the Chequers meeting in July. That's what we are working to deliver for people in this country. We want to deliver a Brexit that delivers on the vote of the British people and that ensures we protect jobs and security. And what would Labour deliver? They're havering around. They think free movement could still continue. That won't deliver on the vote of the British people. They now want a second referendum to go back to the British people and say, oh, we're terribly sorry, we think you got it wrong. There will be no second referendum. The people voted and this government will deliver on it.
I'll just let you all have a quick sort of 20 seconds each on what you think the deal should be. Obviously, we don't want no deal. What should it be, Nicola?
It should be a deal where we have a good, strong relationship with the EU. We have the exact same benefits that we have now.
But we don't have any say.
How do you mean we don't have any say?
Well, we don't have MEPs and we don't have any say in Council of Ministers, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know that.
Kevin, what do you think?
We stay. I come from a Remainer city and we stay.
I think we just go for the Norway option. The Norwegians have never been in the EU, but they're basically in it. But they
what about
just
this Canada option?
Well, the Canada option is a free trade deal, do you know how long it takes to do free trade deals? About 25 years.
Okay. So,
minimum.
That's it. Thanks very much to our guests. That's Labour Councillor Frombale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, also Kevin Carhill and Martin Summers. We'll be back after the news.
For Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.